Welcome to Asia Calling, your window on Asia. This week, we bring you a World Environment Day special. We take a look at Thailand's giant and grotesque-looking water monitor. The unique lizard is being hard hit by climate change and urbanisation. In Pakistan's Thar Desert, innovative new ways to deal with water shortages. And mining companies failing to clean up after themselves in the Philippines. But before all of that, we start in the hotly contested region of Kashmir, where Indian security forces and Kashmir separatists are bringing new and more extreme tactics to a conflict that has simmered for 3 decades. Thanks for tuning into the show. I'm Nicole Kirby. The Indian-controlled Kashmir region continues to simmer, with no end to protests, clashes and killings. And as Kashmir separatist leaders are arrested, young school students are joining street protests in their place, adding a new dimension to an ongoing conflict. Bismillah Galani reports from New Delhi.
In Kashmir's Thral district, tens of thousands of people have gathered for the funeral of young militant leader Sabzar Ahmad. He was killed in a shootout with Indian forces last week, and the mourners here are angry. They are shouting anti-India slogans and demanding Azadi, or freedom. A local leader, Saifullah, addresses the crowd.
He gave his life for a great cause. He is a martyr. He did his job and now it's our responsibility to take his mission forward. Let's refresh our pledge that we won't stop until we free Kashmir from Indian occupation.
A group of armed men wearing masks seem to appear from nowhere. They pay homage to their friend with gun salutes. One spontaneously turns to the crowd and passionately pleads with them to understand why he joined the militants.
We have been left with no other way. We are being forced to take up arms. I asked my elders, what else can one do when there's such oppression, when the honor and dignity of our mothers and sisters is being violated, when our brothers are either killed or put behind bars to rot?
Kashmir is a disputed territory. It has been the source of ongoing conflict between India and Pakistan since the Indian subcontinent was partitioned in 1947. Nearly 100,000 people have been killed in the region since the late 1980s, when an armed uprising against Indian rule triggered violent clashes. Those clashes have continued on and off for 3 decades. Last July, this same town grieved for Burhan Wani, who had also become known as the poster boy of new militancy in Kashmir. Sabzar continued Burhan's legacy, and spokesperson for Indian paramilitary forces, Rajesh Yadav, says his death is a boon.
The last 2 days have been great for us in North Kashmir and South Kashmir. We have eliminated 10 terrorists, including Sabzar, who had replaced Burhan Wani. This is a great achievement.
Burhan's killing last year sparked a chain of protests and clashes, which led to 150 deaths. The region was under total security lockdown for nearly 6 months. Curfews controlled movement, businesses and educational institutions closed, and mobile and internet services were blocked. Now, after Sabzar's death, the curfew and internet blockade has been reinstated. Protesters are also back on the streets with greater intensity. And with separatist leaders behind bars and under house arrest, the protests now look very different. Children in school uniforms dominate the protests.
First, our grandfathers went through all this and they were killed. and then our fathers, and now our brothers and children are in the same situation and are being killed. How long can this go on? We won't allow this anymore. And look at how cruelly they are treating the students. Where else are students killed with bullets and pellets?
Despite growing casualties, protesters are becoming more fearless. They now jump between fighting Kashmiri militants and Indian forces, breaking the security cordon and helping militants flee.
The big problem right now is that there's no leadership. You know, it's almost as if these young boys and girls, they are out on the streets with a death wish. And they are taunting the Indian state that, come, we are ready to die, you kill us. Let's see how many of us you can kill.
Indian security forces are adopting new methods too. Recently, an Indian army officer tied a Kashmiri civilian to the front of his vehicle and used him as a human shield as he passed through an area under protesters' control. Later, the army chief announced an award for the officer, calling his act innovative. Journalist Prem Shankar Jha says, the Indian government has lost the moral high ground in Kashmir.
You lose the moral high ground. You lost it today in Kashmir completely. You're losing it with the intelligentsia in India. And very soon you'll lose it with the world. We were destroyed in Kashmir. There is no one behind us today, I'm sorry to say.
In response to the worsening situation in Kashmir, countries like Iran and Turkey have offered to mediate between India and Pakistan to resolve the issue. India has refused mediation and won't talk to either Pakistan or the Kashmiri youth. But Kapil Kak, member of a civil society group, Center for Peace and Progress, that is trying to facilitate talks, believes the only way forward is through dialogue with all stakeholders.
Three generations have seen this conflict. There has been failure on the part of the central government in addressing the root problems of Kashmir. So we will keep confronting this. We need to address Jammu and Kashmir issue once for all in a political outreach which is sensitive, which is caring, which is people-oriented.
From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
Life is a constant struggle for water in the Thar Desert, an area that spreads across the Indian subcontinent. After almost a decade of drought, the government is pinning its hopes on a new strategy, reverse osmosis plants. Our reporter Naeem Sahutra travelled to the Thar Desert to find out more.
This melancholic song is about a young and beautiful girl's miseries, about life in the Thar Desert. The song tells the story of a folk tale about a young woman called Marvi Marachi. One day Marvi goes to fetch water from the well, but she is kidnapped by the powerful king Umar Sumro, who wants to marry her. The story might be a myth, but the well is real. I'm here with Pancho Devi on a scorching afternoon in the desert, and she's taking me to that historic well, Marvi's well. Pancho is balancing an earthen pot on her head and carrying her son in her arms as she walks through the hot sand barefoot. Each day she does this trip several times, half a kilometer each way, fetching water for the household and her gods. Pancho pulls the long rope, which is tied to the rusty iron pot, to draw water from the well. It takes 20 minutes of pulling at the rope to fill the pot with just 8 liters of water. It comes up all black and filled with dirt.
I fetch water from Mavi's well because there's no other source of water. But the water in the well is also getting filthy. There's no other source of drinking water, so I take it from the well twice a day.
This is the world's 9th largest subtropical desert. It's spread across 320,000 kilometers between India and Pakistan. Here in southern Pakistan region of that desert, the subsoil water is the only source of life in the arid region. The subsoil water has high level of salt and is barely fit for consumption. But there isn't much choice. Pancho can hardly remember the last time it rained.
There are no rains. There were no rains last year. In fact, there's been no rain for years. Therefore, there is no water for the crops as well, and we have to wait days for showers.
Inside the traditional small hut where Pancho lives with her family, her 2-year-old son Murchand is crying. She knows it's because he's sick and hungry, but she's too weak to breastfeed him. This area has one of the highest levels of malnutrition in the world. In the past 2 years, 2,000 people in this region have died from waterborne diseases, among them 350 malnourished children. To cope with the drought, the government has launched a mega project installing 150 reverse osmosis plants to provide clean drinking water. Reverse osmosis, or RO, is a process in which dissolved inorganic solids such as salt are removed from the water to make it safe to drink. Here in Thar, 150 small RO plants have also been installed in the far-flung villages. Each plant, essentially a small shed with pumps that suck up subsoil water, can desalinate 100,000 gallons of water every day. Villagers like 45-year-old Lal Bhai say the plant has changed their lives.
I've seen water problems throughout my life. Earlier, I would fetch water on my head from wells in far-off areas, but that was salty. No, we don't have any problem of water shortage anymore. This water is sweet water. It's so tasty. Everyone in the village is so happy.
One of the best things about the plants? Lai says she can now take a shower twice a day if she wants to. The animals are also happy. The last time I visited this area 2 years ago, the desert was littered with the skeletons of dead animals and people were migrating to other cities. Ratanlal was one of them. He moved to Karachi to find work, but he since returned home to the desert. It was hard being Hindu in the city, but majority of Karachiites are Muslim. And besides, water is now readily available in Thar.
RO plants have just changed our lives, but many are built on the land, which is owned by politicians and well-connected people, so they can lock and open the premises whenever they want. If that happens, people in the village again have to go to the wells.
But the RO plants are not everywhere. They haven't reached Pancho's village yet. Life in Thar Desert is a constant struggle for water. Many wells, like Marvi's, will continue to be used in the future.
ਪਰ ਚਨੀ ਸ਼ਾਲ ਪਵਾਰ
Who is your calling? This is Naeem Sohotra in Tharparkar, Pakistan.
You're listening to Asia Calling KBR. For centuries, foreign powers travelled to the Philippines to take the country's natural resources, gold, copper, and other valuable minerals. These days, though, it's multinational mining companies. And in their wake, these firms have left huge environmental damage behind. Residents on one Philippine island say they still haven't received sufficient compensation from a Canadian company that 2 decades ago caused a huge mining disaster. Jason Strother has more from the island province of Marinduque.
Elisa Hernandez dips her yellow blouse into the Boac River's rushing water and then slaps it up against the shoreline's gray stones. The 73-year-old used to earn a living washing her whole community's laundry this way.
We felt like home in this river. It was so clean. We played in it, and we used to catch a lot of fish here too.
But that all changed in March 1996. That's when a damaged pipe inside a copper mine burst about 20 kilometers upstream. Millions of tons of toxic waste, including lead and arsenic, flooded into the river. At the time, it was the worst mining disaster in the country's history. For Hernandez and thousands of other Marinduque residents, many of whom are farmers and fishermen, the spill killed off their main source of income, and it has never fully recovered.
After the incident, I started to break out with skin disease from the toxins in the water. I'm cured now, but people no longer wanted me to wash their clothes in the river.
Hernandez was party to a decade-long lawsuit against the Barrick Gold Corporation, the Canadian firm that bought Placer Dome, the company that managed the Marcopper mine. The plaintiffs alleged the company polluted Marinduque's land, waterways, and poisoned its residents. A judge in the United States dismissed the case last year on jurisdiction grounds. Despite the court's verdict, the province isn't giving up its fight, says Adeline Angeles, a local legislator and member of the Marinduque Council for Environmental Concerns, an organization that was part of the lawsuit. Angeles says when mining began on her island in the 1960s, people believed that it would make the province rich.
After decades of mining, Marinduque is one of the poorest provinces in the entire archipelago. And at the same time, our waters are silted. The rivers cannot be used for irrigation purposes. And, you know, the farmers became poorer.
The Canadian mining company Barrick Gold says $50 million U.S. dollars in compensation has already been paid. The Marinduque government says much of that was never received. Today, the Marcopper site sits abandoned. It took some convincing and a generous fare to persuade a passenger truck driver to take me into the site. Heading up the rocky road, I sit in the back as we drive past armed guards. There's an overgrown golf course here and even an airplane landing strip. In the distance is a barren hilltop, which was Marcopper's first open pit mine. We arrive at the second pit, which is filled up with metallic blue water and surrounded by a gravelly moonscape. In the Philippines, Marinduque has become the symbol of anti-mining activism. It's a reminder of what can go wrong when foreign firms from wealthy nations operate virtually unchecked in the developing world.
The people, united, will never be defeated.
Anti-mining activists protest against what they say is the continued plundering of the Philippines' resources. They claim foreign mining companies give little back to the communities they devastate.
Resist mining plunder.
Camilo Manio is with the group Ayensa Tigo Mina.
Yeah, since the birth of the Philippines, always foreign countries or foreign nationals or foreign corporations go here because of rich minerals.
He says it started with Spain and then the Americans and Japanese. Now Chinese, Australian and Canadian firms all run mines here. Citing government figures, Manio says it's a myth that mining makes the Philippines wealthier.
Only 2% of the tax from the mining industries were given to the local government. Up to 1% the mining contribution to the GDP.
The group is calling for an all-out ban on foreign mining companies in the Philippines. But Roland De Jesus, a director at the Mines and Geoscience Bureau in Manila, says mining in the Philippines is safer now. As for Marinduque, he says it's not Manila's responsibility to clean up the mess that a private company left behind, but he offers another solution.
One of the alternatives is to resume mining. Based on the actual production rate of the company, when they suddenly stopped, they still have around 17 years of mine life.
He says that's only an alternative if a company has the financial and technical capabilities to rehabilitate the damage caused by the previous operator. De Jesus adds that another disaster, like the one that happened in Marinduque, won't happen again because new laws hold companies more accountable for environmental damage. Marinduque environmental advocate Adeline Angeles says reopening that mine is an unacceptable option.
We cannot take another risk. It's just like trying to address a victim of rape by opening itself for possible rape again.
The island is now moving forward with launching a new lawsuit against the mining firm in Canada, but any compensation might not come soon enough. For Asia Calling, I'm Jason Strother in Marinduque, the Philippines.
Researchers say the Asian water monitor is amongst the creatures likely to be hardest hit by climate change. Like other reptiles, they're particularly sensitive to global warming because they regulate their body temperature by basking in the sun and cooling off in the shade. It's thought about 20% of all lizard species will become extinct in the next 60 years. And as development encroaches on the natural habitats of lizards, it's becoming harder for them to survive. On top of all of that, in Thailand, water lizards are traditionally considered bad luck. From Bangkok, Kanika Pechkau has this story.
It's another tranquil morning here in Lumpini Park, the biggest public park in Bangkok. With 140 acres of chain and ponds, is an oasis in the middle of a concrete jungle, a welcome respite from the city's heat. People are jogging, walking, and lying comfortably on the green grass. But there's some unusual activity here this morning. Dozens of men are running wild, with ropes, nets, and sticks in hand. They throw fresh feet on the ground, trying to tempt the lizards out of their hiding place. After hours of chasing and hunting, they've got their catch, about 30 lizards. They throw brown sacks onto the back of the waiting trucks and drive away. Nippon is a long-time visitor to the park. He's witnessed the morning catch, and he's angry.
Why are you doing that to them? They just live peacefully. And look, the way you tie their neck and drag them along, is that what you do? They have never harmed anybody.
Nippon likes seeing the lizards in the park, but not everybody agrees. You see, some Thai people believe the lizards are bad luck. So many people are scared of them. And it's not surprising, really. They are about 3 meters long, with brown lumpy skin and a long red tongue. They look a bit like a really ugly crocodile, which is why some visitors to the park started complaining to the authorities. Suwana works for Bangkok's Environment Department, and she's responsible for the cache. She insists they should be taking serious measures to control the lizards.
I do understand that they won't harm the people, but they do harm the environment. All nice garden we made, they also destroy our pond too.
But there's a lot of disagreement about the city's attempt to control lizard numbers. The water lizards are an endangered species, and so authorities have to be very careful in how they control their numbers in the city parks. Tuen Chai Nut Damrong is a wildlife specialist. She agrees that lizard populations need to be controlled, but thinks the city environment department is being too harsh.
If we could just find two or three of their spawning places, we could control hundreds of them. But to just get rid of them, that doesn't help.
Masuwana disagrees.
They can live in the natural environment, but they need to be controlled. I'm not sure we can do that efficiently if we just control their spawning.
It's thought about 400 water lizards have lived in the park for a long time. The cache we saw this morning took 30 of them to a wildlife rehabilitation center 100 kilometers away, an environment that is not ideal for the lizards. And in the chaos, many lizards escaped the park and ran into the city. It's feared many were killed by traffic, and others won't survive the harsh environment. Bangkok was once a swampy village at the mouth of the Chao Phraya River, and the natural habitat for the water lizards and many other reptiles. But as city spread, concrete and paved roads transformed the city into an urban jungle, destroying the lizard natural environment. The lizards have survived by finding refuge in shady areas where they can protect themselves from the heat. An hour away from Lumpini Park at Silapakorn University, Mu and Huang are feeding the water lizards, happily swimming in the ponds. They come here every day and have even given the lizards their own names.
Sometimes seven of them would climb up here. Sometimes it would be three or four of them. It depends. At midday, when people have their lunch, the lizard would know and they would come up for the food.
Huang has seen the water lizards ever since he started working here 20 years ago.
It would feel strange if I wouldn't see them each day. Where are they gone? I would ask everybody. People would ask where the lizard were whenever they disappeared. I would have chicken bones for them, and if they didn't come to take it, I would miss them.
Just as Huang sees the lizards as friends, so does Mu. She says there's no problem with the number of lizards here.
We've lived together for decades. They're not outnumbering us. They're spread all over the campus. We don't feel any threat from the number of lizards.
In the old days, they would live at the canal and mangrove forest, looking for fish in the natural way. Now that we live in their place, it's no surprise that they would come close to us.
Back at Lumpini Park, the walkers and runners go on as usual. Only now, they are seeing fewer water lizards than before. So while people are trying to survive in this chaotic city of Bangkok, so too are the water lizards of Lumpini Park. For Asia Calling, this is Kanika Petkal in Bangkok, Thailand.
That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling for more updates. You can now also podcast the show. Go to the iTunes store and search for Asia Calling and subscribe for free to the weekly episodes. I'm Nicole Kirby, back next week with more stories from Asia.